in their holding area on Fifth Avenue, couldn't see us arrive, nor could the protesters in their own holding area not far away. Still, it was quite the scene in the comparatively quiet Trump Tower residence's lobby. We were a two-elevator crowd of leaders and protectors. One elevator discharged a lady going to walk her tiny dog. She and her dog, both wearing expensive coats against a cold Fifth Avenue day, passed through our tight pack of dark suits and armed men. Chief spies holding locked bags with our nation's secrets politely mumbled, "Excuse us." After all the live TV images of job applicants and dignitaries coming and going through the gilded Fifth Avenue lobby as though on a reality TV show, the leaders of our country's biggest intelligence agencies were sneaking in to see the president-elect. We were sneaking in to tell him what Russia had done to try to help elect him. This was to be the third and final briefing session by the leadership of the intelligence community, referred to inside the government as the IC, to describe the classified findings of an intelligence community assessment, ICA, of Russia's actions during the presidential election. At President Obama's direction, analysts from the CIA, NSA, and FBI, coordinated by senior analysts from ODNI, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, had spent a month pulling together all sources of information to offer government officials, as well as the incoming Trump administration, a complete picture of the level of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential campaign. A watered-down, unclassified version of the ICA had been prepared for public release, but this was the meaty stuff. This was about sharing the most sensitive information, including sources and methods, precisely how we knew what we knew, spelling out in great detail why we had achieved the unusual state of a joint high-confidence opinion that Russia had intervened extensively in an American presidential election. The four agencies had joined in the assessment, which was both stunning and straightforward. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered an extensive effort to influence the 2016 presidential election. That effort, which came through cyber activity, social media, and Russian state media, had a variety of goals: undermining public faith in the American democratic process, denigrating Hillary Clinton and harming her electability and potential presidency, and helping Donald Trump get elected. Our first briefing on the assessment had occurred the day before, January 5, 2017, with the incumbent of the Oval Office. In front of President Obama, Vice President Biden, and their senior aides, Jim Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, laid out the work that had been done, the conclusions reached, and the basis for those conclusions. The president asked a variety of questions, as did the vice president. It was at moments like this when I occasionally caught a glimpse of the warm, brotherly, and sometimes exasperating relationship between Barack Obama and Joe Biden, two very different personalities. The pattern was usually the same. President Obama would have a series of exchanges, heading a conversation very clearly and crisply in direction A. Then at some point, Biden would jump in with, "Can I ask something, Mr. President?" Obama would politely agree, but something in his expression suggested he knew full well that for the next 5 or 10 minutes we would all be heading in direction Z. After listening and patiently waiting, President Obama would then bring the conversation back on course. In this instance, we stayed on track. After an extended discussion on the intelligence assessment, the president asked what the plan was for further briefings. Director Clapper explained that we were to meet the Gang of Eight the next morning, the top officials in Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, briefed on intelligence matters, and then we would go immediately to New York City to brief the president-elect and his senior team. Clapper explained to Obama that there was an unusual matter that needed to be brought to Mr. Trump's attention, additional material, what would become commonly called the Steele dossier, that contained a variety of allegations about Trump. The material had been assembled by an individual considered reliable, a former Allied intelligence officer, but it had not been fully validated. The material included some wild stuff. Among that stuff were unconfirmed allegations that the president-elect had been engaged in unusual sexual activities with prostitutes in Russia while on a trip to Moscow in 2013, activities that at one point involved prostitutes urinating on a hotel bed in the presidential suite of the Ritz-Carlton that the Obamas had used while on a visit there. Another allegation was that these activities were filmed by Russian intelligence for the possible purpose of blackmail against the president-elect. Director Clapper explained that we believed the media were about to report on this material, and therefore we had concluded it was important for the intelligence community to alert the incoming president. Obama did not appear to have any reaction to any of this, at least none he would share with us. In a level voice, he said, "What's the plan for that briefing?" With just the briefest of sidelong glances at me, Clapper took a breath, then said, "We have decided that Director Comey will meet alone with the president-elect to brief him on this material following the completion of the full ICA briefing." The president did not say a word. Instead, he turned his head to his left and looked directly at me. He raised and lowered both of his eyebrows with emphasis and then looked away. I suppose you can read whatever you want into a wordless expression, but to my mind, his Groucho Marx eyebrow raise was both subtle humor and an expression of concern. It was almost as if he were saying, "Good luck with that." I began to feel a lump in my stomach. As the meeting broke up, my eyes fixed on the bowl of apples on the Oval Office coffee table. Because the President and Mrs. Obama were very health conscious, the First Lady had run a campaign in schools about exchanging junk food for fruits and vegetables, the apples had been a fixture of the Oval Office for years. I wasn't entirely certain they were edible, but I once saw Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough grab two at a time. He surely wasn't eating plastic fruit replicas. My youngest daughter long ago had asked me to get her a presidential apple, and this was surely the last time the Oval Office, an apple, and I would ever be together, now or never. Swipe an apple at the close of a meeting about Russian interference? So tacky. But fatherhood beats tacky. I scooped an apple. Nobody stopped me. I photographed it in the car and texted the picture to my daughter, delivering the product that evening. She let me taste a slice, not plastic. Later that day, I received a call from Jay Johnson, the Secretary of Homeland Security, who had been a friend since we were federal prosecutors together in Manhattan in the 1980s. He had been in the Oval Office that morning for the briefing. I have no idea whether he was calling me at President Obama's suggestion, or if the two even spoke about the matter, but he gave voice to how I viewed the Oval Office eyebrow raise. "Jim, I'm worried about this plan for you to privately brief the president-elect," he said. "Me too," I replied. "Have you ever met Donald Trump?" he asked. "No." "Jim, please be careful. Be very careful. This may not go well." I thanked Jay for the concern and the call. This was not making me feel better. Still, I could see no way out of it. The FBI was aware of the material. Two United States senators separately contacted me to alert me to its existence and the fact that many in Washington either had it or knew of it. CNN had informed the FBI press office that they were going to run with it as soon as the next day. Whether it was true or not, an important feature of disarming any effort to coerce a public official is to tell the official what the enemy might be doing or saying. The FBI calls that a defensive briefing. How on earth could we brief the man about Russian efforts and not tell him about this piece? But it was so salacious and embarrassing that it didn't make sense to tell him in a group, especially not a group led by Obama appointees who were leaving office the moment Trump became president. I was staying on as FBI director. We knew the information, and the man had to be told. It made complete sense for me to do it. The plan was sensible, if the word applies, in the context of talking with a new president about prostitutes in Moscow. Still, the plan left me deeply uncomfortable. There was more to the discomfort. I long ago learned that people tend to assume that you act and think the way they would in a similar situation. They project their worldview onto you, even if you see the world very differently. There was a real chance that Donald Trump, politician and hardball dealmaker, would assume I was dangling the prostitute thing over him to jam him, to gain leverage. He might well assume I was pulling a J. Edgar Hoover, because that's what Hoover would do in my shoes. An eyebrow raise didn't quite do this situation justice. It was really going to suck. The bit about pulling a J. Edgar Hoover made me keen to have some tool in my bag to reassure the new president. I needed to be prepared to say something, if at all possible, that would take the temperature down. After extensive discussion with my team, I decided I could assure the president-elect that the FBI was not currently investigating him. This was literally true. We did not have a counterintelligence case file open on him. We really didn't care if he had cavorted with hookers in Moscow, so long as the Russians weren't trying to coerce him in some way. The FBI's general counsel, Jim Baker, argued powerfully that such an assurance, although true, could be misleadingly narrow. The president-elect's other conduct was, or surely would be, within the scope of an investigation looking at whether his campaign had coordinated with Russia. There was also the concern that the FBI might then be obligated to tell President Trump if we did open an investigation of him. I saw the logic of this position, but I also saw the bigger danger of the new president, who was known to be impulsive, going to war against the FBI. And I was determined to do all I could, appropriately, to work successfully with the new president. So I rejected Jim Baker's thoughtful advice and headed to Trump Tower with, "We are not investigating you," in my back pocket. Once again, we were in an unprecedented spot. By the beginning of 2017, after all the controversies over the Clinton case, I had become a relatively identifiable public figure. Even if I wanted to hide from view, my height made that even harder. It was clear that any number of Republicans shared Hillary Clinton's view that I'd affected the election result in Trump's favor. As much as Clinton partisans felt anger, and in some cases even hatred, toward me, in Trump world, I was something of a celebrity, which made my entrance into Trump Tower really uncomfortable. I didn't want to be seen as anything different from the other intelligence leaders doing their jobs. We gathered in a small conference room belonging to the Trump Organization. It was blandly decorated and had been outfitted with a temporary heavy gold ceiling-to-floor curtain to block the glass wall that would otherwise show our meeting to the hallway. The president-elect entered the room on time, followed by the vice president-elect and the rest of the designated senior White House team. This was the first time I'd ever seen Donald Trump face-to-face. He appeared shorter than he seemed on a debate stage with Hillary Clinton. Otherwise, as I looked at the president-elect, I was struck that he looked exactly the same in person as on television, which surprised me because people most often look different in person. His suit jacket was open, and his tie too long, as usual. His face appeared slightly orange, with bright white half-moons under his eyes, where I assumed he placed small tanning goggles, and impressively coiffed bright blonde hair, which upon close inspection looked to be all his. I remember wondering how long it must take him in the morning to get that done. As he extended his hand, I made a mental note to check its size. It was smaller than mine, but did not seem unusually so. Trump brought his entire senior team into the small conference room. Vice President-elect Mike Pence, Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, and Press Secretary Sean Spicer sat at the oval conference table, with Trump and Pence seated at opposite ends. They were quiet and serious. As we shook hands, the vice president-elect held the handshake an extra few seconds and said my first name, drawing it out, Jim. It struck me as an odd combination of someone greeting an old friend and consoling that friend. I don't think we had ever met, although I recall our speaking on the phone once 14 years earlier, in 2003, when I was United States Attorney in Manhattan and we were investigating a guy who registered common misspellings of popular children's websites so that when a child mistyped Disneyland.com or BobTheBuilder.com, they were directed to a pornography website. My reaction was, that should be a crime. When I found out it had become a federal crime only months earlier, I asked for the contact information of the member of Congress responsible for the Truth in Domain Names Act so I could thank that person. It turned out to be Indiana Congressman Mike Pence, who told me on the phone that he had pushed for the law after one of his own children was redirected in that sick way. Director Clapper sat closest to the president-elect, with CIA Director John Brennan, NSA Director Mike Rogers, and me to his right. Against the wall behind me sat Trump's future CIA Director Mike Pompeo and designated Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert, and Deputy National Security Advisor K.T. McFarland. The President-elect's CIA intelligence briefer, a career employee assigned to deliver regular intelligence briefings to the incoming president, was also in the room to take notes. By this point, I had worked relatively closely with two presidents, in addition to scores of other leaders in government. I was curious to see how Trump, the classic fish out of water, would operate in a totally foreign role. Running a private, family-held company is, of course, quite different from running a nation, or even running a large public corporation. You have to deal with various constituencies who don't report to you, and to live under a web of laws and regulations that don't apply to a typical CEO. As I'd seen from other leaders, being confident enough to be humble, comfortable in your own skin, is at the heart of effective leadership. That humility makes a whole lot of things possible, none more important than a single humble question: what am I missing? Good leaders constantly worry about their limited ability to see. To rise above those limitations, good leaders exercise judgment, which is a different thing from intelligence. Intelligence is the ability to solve a problem, to decipher a riddle, to master a set of facts. Judgment is the ability to orbit a problem or a set of facts and see it as it might be seen through other eyes, by observers with different biases, motives, and backgrounds. It is also the ability to take a set of facts and move it in place and time, perhaps to a hearing room or a courtroom months or years in the future, or to the newsroom of a major publication or the boardroom of a competitor. Intelligence is the ability to collect and report what the documents and witnesses say. Judgment is the ability to say what those same facts mean and what effect they will have on other audiences. In my first meeting with Trump, I looked to see how he struck that balance of confidence and humility, and whether he showed signs of having sound judgment. I confess I was skeptical going in. My impression from the campaign was that he was a deeply insecure man, which made it impossible for him to demonstrate humility, and that he seemed very unlikely to be confident and humble enough to ask the "what am I missing?" question at the heart of sound judgment. But I didn't see enough at Trump Tower that day to see whether that assessment was correct or not. The president-elect was appropriately subdued and serious. Director Clapper presented the intelligence community assessment, just as he had to President Obama and the Gang of Eight. There were a few questions and comments, most of which came from Tom Bossert in the back row. During the discussion of Russia's involvement in the election, I recall Trump listening without interrupting and asking only one question, which was really more of a statement: "But you found there was no impact on the result, right?" Clapper replied that we had done no such analysis, which was not our business or expertise. What we could say is that we found no evidence of alteration of the vote count. What I found telling was what Trump and his team didn't ask. They were about to lead a country that had been attacked by a foreign adversary, yet they had no questions about what the future Russian threat might be. Nor did they ask how the United States might prepare itself to meet that threat. Instead, with the four of us still in our seats, including two outgoing Obama appointees, the president-elect and his team shifted immediately into a strategy session about messaging on Russia, about how they could spin what we just told them. Speaking as if we weren't there, Priebus began describing what a press statement about this meeting might look like. The Trump team, led by Priebus, with Pence, Spicer, and Trump jumping in, debated how to position these findings for maximum political advantage. They were keen to emphasize that there was no impact on the vote, meaning that the Russians hadn't elected Trump. Clapper interjected to remind them of what he had said about 60 seconds earlier: the intelligence community did not analyze American politics, and we had not offered a view on that. I had been in many intelligence briefings with the two previous presidents, and had never seen Presidents Bush or Obama discuss communications and political strategy in front of intelligence community leaders. There had always been a line: the intelligence community does facts, the White House does politics and spin, and does it on its own. The searing lesson of the Iraq War, based on bad intelligence about weapons of mass destruction, was never mix the two. I tried to tell myself that maybe this was because Trump and his team had little experience on these matters. Trump, of course, had no experience in government whatsoever. But in an instant, the line between intelligence and politics began to fade. As I was sitting there, the strangest image filled my mind. I kept pushing it away because it seemed too odd and too dramatic, but it kept coming back. I thought of New York Mafia social clubs, an image from my days as a Manhattan federal prosecutor in the 1980s and 1990s, the Ravenite, the Palma Boys, Cafe Giardino. I couldn't shake the picture. And looking back, it wasn't as odd and dramatic as I thought it was at the time. The Italian Mafia, as noted earlier, called itself La Cosa Nostra, this thing of ours, and always drew a line between someone who was a friend of yours, meaning someone outside the family, and someone who was a friend of ours, meaning an official member of the family. I sat there thinking, holy crap, they're trying to make each of us an amica nostra, a friend of ours, to draw us in. As crazy as it sounds, I suddenly had the feeling that, in the blink of an eye, the president-elect was trying to make us all part of the same family, and that Team Trump had made it a thing of ours. For my entire career, intelligence was a thing of mine, and political spin a thing of yours. Team Trump wanted to change that. I should have said something right then. After all, I hadn't exactly been shy when it came to asserting myself to leaders in other administrations. I'm not sure it would have made a difference, but maybe I should have told the new team about the norms of behavior developed over generations in fits and starts to try to keep politics out of intelligence, to ensure that the president gets the best facts, whether he likes them or not, and to insulate the intelligence community from charges that its conclusions are politically cooked. Thinking that intelligence leaders would willingly contribute to a conversation about how to do PR in support of any presidential administration was at best a naive notion, reflecting a misunderstanding of our role. Thinking that members of the outgoing Obama administration would be part of such an effort was just dumb. But in that moment, I convinced myself that speaking up would be crazy. I didn't know these people, and they didn't know me. We had just served up, "The Russians tried to get you elected." Should I now give them a lecture about how to behave with us? And when I'm about to have a private session with the president-elect to talk about Russian hookers? Nope, don't think so. So I said nothing. And nobody else said anything either. Nobody on the Trump team thought to say, "Hey, maybe this is a conversation for later, or perhaps we should move on, Mr. President-elect." I actually think it was Trump who ended the communications strategy session by saying they could talk about it at another time. At that point, Reince Priebus asked if there was anything else that we should tell them. Here we go, I thought. Clapper said, "Well, yes, there is some additional sensitive material that we thought it made sense for Director Comey to review with you in a smaller group. We will excuse ourselves so he can discuss it privately with you." "Okay, how small?" the president-elect asked, looking at me. "It's up to you, sir," I said, "but I was thinking the two of us." Reince Priebus interjected, "How about me and the vice president-elect?" "That's fine, sir," I answered, turning to the president-elect. "It's entirely up to you. I just didn't want to do it with a larger group." I don't know if Trump knew what I was about to say, but the president-elect waved his hand at Priebus and then pointed at me. "Just the two of us. Thanks, everybody." The group shook hands with the visitors and everyone filed out. Jay Johnson's words banged around my head. "Jim, please be careful. Be very careful." We waited quietly while the others filed out. When we were alone, the president-elect spoke first, throwing out compliments. "You've had one heck of a year," he said, adding that I handled the email investigation honorably and had a great reputation. This was nice of him to say, and there seemed to be genuine concern and appreciation in his voice. I nodded in gratitude with a tight smile. He said that the people of the FBI really like you, and expressed his hope that I would stay on as director. I replied, "I intend to, sir." Though it might have been the politer, obvious thing to say to ingratiate myself with the president-elect, I didn't thank him for saying this, because I already had the job, for a stated 10-year term, and didn't want it to appear as if I needed to reapply. In fact, only once in the Bureau's history was an FBI director fired before the end of his term, when Bill Clinton, without controversy, removed William Sessions in 1993 over allegations of serious ethical improprieties. Ironically, the man Clinton replaced him with, Louis Freeh, turned out to be a thorn in the administration's side as he pressed aggressively for investigations of alleged administration misdeeds. After Trump finished with his opening monologue, which lasted for a minute or so, I explained the nature of the material I was about to discuss and why we thought it important that he know about it. I then began to summarize the allegation in the dossier that he had been with prostitutes in a Moscow hotel in 2013 and that the Russians had filmed the episode. I didn't mention one particular allegation in the dossier, that he was having prostitutes urinate on each other on the very bed President Obama and the First Lady had once slept in as a way of soiling the bed. I figure that single detail was not necessary to put him on notice about the material. This whole thing was weird enough. As I spoke, I felt a strange out-of-body experience, as if I were watching myself speak to the new president about prostitutes in Russia. Before I finished, Trump interrupted sharply with a dismissive tone. He was eager to protest that the allegations weren't true. I explained that I wasn't saying the FBI believed the allegations. We simply thought it important that he know they were out there and being widely circulated. I added that one of the FBI's jobs is to protect the presidency from any kind of coercion, and whether or not the allegations were true, it was important that he know Russians might be saying such things. I stressed that we did not want to keep information from him, particularly given that the press was about to report it. He again strongly denied the allegations, asking, rhetorically I assumed, whether he seemed like a guy who needed the services of prostitutes. He then began discussing cases where women had accused him of sexual assault, a subject I had not raised. He mentioned a number of women and seemed to have memorized their allegations. As he began to grow more defensive and the conversation teetered toward disaster, on instinct I pulled the tool from my bag. "We are not investigating you, sir." That seemed to quiet him. My job done, the conversation ended, we shook hands, and I left the conference room. The entire private session took about 5 minutes, and now I was away, retracing my steps to go out the back entrance. The other directors had gone ahead. On the way down the hall, I passed two men in winter coats coming the other way. One looked familiar, but I kept walking. When he was past me, he called, "Director Comey?" And I stopped and turned. Jared Kushner introduced himself. We shook hands, and I continued on my way. I walked out the side door, stepped into the armored car, and headed to the Manhattan FBI office to do what I loved. I walked floor upon floor of FBI offices and cubicles, thanking incredible people for their work. After the uncomfortable conversation I just had, it was like taking a shower. On January 10th, 4 days after my meeting with Trump, the online publication BuzzFeed published in full the 35-page dossier that I had briefed Trump on. The article began, "A dossier making explosive but unverified allegations that the Russian government has been cultivating, supporting, and assisting President-elect Donald Trump for years and gained compromising information about him has been circulating among elected officials, intelligence agents, and journalists for weeks. The dossier, which is a collection of memos written over a period of months, includes specific, unverified, and potentially unverifiable allegations of contact between Trump aides and Russian operatives, and graphic claims of sexual acts documented by the Russians." In response, the president-elect tweeted, "Fake news, a total political witch hunt." The following day, January 11th, I had another conversation with the future president. In 3 years working under President Obama, I'd never spoken to him on the phone, and only talked to him alone in person twice. Yet here I was, still in the Obama administration, standing in my FBI headquarters office window, having my second private conversation with Donald Trump in 5 days. Below me, as I held the phone to my ear, I could see cars moving on a darkened Pennsylvania Avenue. Across the street, the Justice Department was aglow with busy offices. I remember looking up and to my right at the brightly lit Washington Monument. I could see it rising high above the new Trump Hotel that had just been opened on Pennsylvania Avenue, walking distance from the White House. President-elect Trump was calling from New York. He started the call by again praising me, which now seemed like a conversational device rather than a sincere expression of approval. He added, "I sure hope you're going to stay." I assured him, again, that I was staying at the FBI. He then moved to the purpose of the call. He said he was very concerned about the leaking of the Russian dossier and how it happened. I wasn't sure if he was implying that a federal agency had leaked it, so I explained that the dossier was not a government document. It had been compiled by private parties and then given to many people, including in Congress and the press. The FBI hadn't asked that it be created or paid for it to be created. The document was not classified and not a government document, so it really wasn't correct that it had been leaked. He then said he had been thinking more about the part I had briefed him about privately at Trump Tower. He had been talking to people who had gone with him on the trip to Moscow for the Miss Universe 2013 pageant. He now recalled that he had not even stayed overnight in Moscow. He claimed he had flown from New York, had only gone to the hotel to change his clothes, and had flown home that same night. And then he surprised me by bringing up the one allegation I had specifically tried not to discuss with him. Another reason you know this isn't true. I'm a germaphobe. There's no way I would let people pee on each other around me. No way. I actually let out an audible laugh. I decided not to tell him that the activity alleged did not seem to require either an overnight stay or even being in close proximity to the participants. In fact, though I didn't know for sure, I imagined the presidential suite of the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow was large enough for a germaphobe to be at a safe distance from the activity. I thought all of that and said none of it. Instead, I stared out at the monuments and wondered what had happened to me and our country that the FBI director was talking about this with our incoming president. Having delivered his defense on a subject I didn't care about for the second time, the president-elect ended the call. I went to find my chief of staff, Jim Rubicki, to tell him the world had gone crazy and I was caught in the middle of it. It stayed crazy. Chapter 13. Tests of Loyalty. Friendship, connections, family ties, trust, loyalty, obedience. This was the glue that held us together. Mafia boss Joseph Bonanno, in his autobiography, Man of Honor. Donald J. Trump was inaugurated the 45th President of the United States on January 20th, 2017. Before a crowd whose number immediately and famously came into dispute. The new president was determined to demonstrate that the number of spectators who turned out for him, which was sizable, surpassed the number of people present for Barack Obama's 2009 inauguration. They did not. No evidence, photographic or otherwise, would move him off his view, which, as far as everyone but his press team seemed to agree, was simply false. This small moment was deeply disconcerting to those of us in the business of trying to find the truth, whether in a criminal investigation or in assessing the plans and intentions of America's adversaries. Much of life is ambiguous and subject to interpretation, but there are things that are objectively, verifiably either true or false. It was simply not true that the biggest crowd in history attended the inauguration, as he asserted, or even that Trump's crowd was bigger than Obama's. To say otherwise was not to offer an opinion, a view, a perspective. It was a lie. 2 days later, on Sunday, January 22nd, I attended a late afternoon reception at the White House for the leaders of the various law enforcement agencies who had provided security and support for the inaugural activities. The FBI's counterterrorism, intelligence, and SWAT capabilities had been deployed that day, closely integrated with the Secret Service, as they are for every inauguration. I was told President Trump wanted to thank the agencies for all their hard work. This struck me as a really nice thing for the president to do. Despite that, I didn't love the idea of going personally, for a couple of reasons. First, I didn't think it would be helpful for the FBI if I were seen in videos or photographs hanging around with the new president. Given that so many people seemed to think I'd helped to elect him, it made little sense to support a false narrative that I, and by inference the Bureau, was somehow close to President Trump. Second, the NFL Conference Championship games were on TV. The 5 p.m. reception would cause me to miss the end of the Packers against the Falcons and the beginning of the Steelers against the Patriots. Was the new president not a football fan? But my staff argued that it was important for me to go. I was the FBI director. I didn't want to insult the other leaders or the new administration by not showing up, and I told myself my concerns were overblown. This would be a group reception, and that meant no individual press pictures of me with the president. Also, I decided to record the football games on my DVR, and avoid any conversation about the scores until I had the chance to watch. So I went to the White House. Just as I'd hoped, the reception began as a pleasant mingling with the law enforcement leaders from local, state, and federal agencies. There were about 30 of us there, including leaders of the United States Capitol Police, the Washington Metropolitan Police, and the United States Park Police. These people and their agencies were long-standing partners of the FBI, and many of us knew each other from that work. We gathered in the large oval blue room in the residence of the White House. At the edges of the room, the White House staff had set up small tables with finger foods and non-alcoholic drinks. I moved around the room shaking hands and thanking folks for their work with the FBI. I was preoccupied about keeping a healthy distance from Trump, so I figured out which way the president would likely enter the room and mingled my way to the opposite end, by the windows looking over the South Lawn toward the Washington Monument. I couldn't get farther away without climbing out the window, an option that would begin to look more appealing as time went by. Feeling safe at the far end of the room, I settled next to Joe Clancy, the director of the Secret Service. Clancy, a former head of the Presidential Protective Division, had been called out of retirement by President Obama to lead the troubled agency. His wife remained in Philadelphia, so I inquired after her and their daughter, whom I'd seen sing at a ceremony marking the 150th anniversary of the Secret Service. I often joked that the Secret Service was an older sibling to the FBI, which was only a century old, and its agents had trained our first special agents. Clancy is a wonderful, warm, down-to-earth person. As he and I were chatting, the double doors opened, and White House staffers entered with tall Klieg lights, setting them up to illuminate the area farthest from me by the doors. I had guessed the location of the president's entrance correctly, but I worried that the bright lights meant there would be cameras and reporters, which struck me as unusual for an event to thank low-key law enforcement officials. Moments later, the president and vice president entered. A crush of photographers and TV cameras were ushered in and encircled the two men. The president began speaking, and his eyes swept the room at the leaders who were spread around the perimeter. His gaze passed me, mercifully, and instead came to rest on Joe Clancy. He called Joe's name and motioned him across the room to join him and the vice president. Joe never seeks the spotlight, but he dutifully walked into the near-blinding glow of TV lights. The president hugged him, awkwardly, and asked him to stand with him and the vice president as if on display. Trump then continued talking, looking to his left and away from me. I couldn't believe my luck. He hadn't seen me. How is that possible? Then it occurred to me. I was standing against a heavy blue curtain. I was wearing a blue suit that didn't match the curtain exactly, but was pretty close. It must be camouflaging me. How great is that? I was thinking, I'm so lucky they held the event in this room because I didn't have suits that blend in the green or red rooms. Now that it was my salvation, I moved even closer to the curtain, pressing my back against it, desperately trying to erase myself from the president's field of vision. I literally clung to the blue curtain, all in the hope that I could avoid an ill-advised and totally awkward televised hug from the new president of the United States. My curtain call worked, until it didn't. Still speaking in his usual stream of consciousness and free association cadence, the president moved his eyes again, sweeping from left to right, toward me and my protective curtain. This time I was not so lucky. The small eyes with the white shadows stopped on me. "Jim," Trump exclaimed. The president called me forward. "He's more famous than me." Awesome. My wife Patrice has known me since I was 19. In the endless TV coverage of what felt to me like a 1,000-yard walk across the blue room, back at our home, she was watching TV and pointing at the screen. "That's Jim's oh shit face." Yes, it was. My inner voice was screaming, "How could he think this is a good idea? Isn't he supposed to be the master of television? This is a complete disaster, and there's no freaking way I'm going to hug him." The FBI and its director are not on anyone's political team. The entire nightmare of the Clinton email investigation had been about protecting the integrity and independence of the FBI and the Department of Justice, about safeguarding the reservoir of trust and credibility. That Trump would appear to publicly thank me on his second day in office was a threat to the reservoir. Near the end of my 1,000-yard walk, I extended my right hand to President Trump. This was going to be a handshake, nothing more. The president gripped my hand, then he pulled it forward and down. There it was. He was going for the hug on national TV. I tightened the right side of my body, calling on years of side planks and dumbbell rows. He was not going to get a hug without being a whole lot stronger than he looked. He wasn't. I thwarted the hug, but I got something worse in exchange. The president leaned in and put his mouth near my right ear. "I'm really looking forward to working with you," he said. Unfortunately, because of the vantage point of the TV cameras, what many in the world, including my children, thought they saw was a kiss. The whole world saw Donald Trump kiss the man who some believe got him elected. Surely this couldn't get any worse. President Trump made a motion as if to invite me to stand with him and the vice president and Joe Clancy. Backing away, I waved it off with a smile. "I'm not worthy," my expression tried to say. "I'm not suicidal," my inner voice said. Defeated and depressed, I retreated back to the far side of the room. The press was excused, and the police chiefs and directors started lining up for pictures with the president. They were very quiet. I made like I was getting in the back of the line and slipped out the side door, through the green room, into the hall, and down the stairs. On the way, I heard someone say the score from the Packers-Falcons game. Perfect. It's possible that I was reading too much into the usual Trump theatrics, but the episode left me worried. It was no surprise that President Trump behaved in a manner that was completely different from his predecessors. I couldn't imagine Barack Obama or George W. Bush asking someone to come on stage like a contestant on The Price is Right. What was distressing was what Trump symbolically seemed to be asking leaders of the law enforcement and national security agencies to do. To come forward and kiss the great man's ring. To show their deference and loyalty. It was tremendously important that these leaders not do that, or be seen to even look like they were doing that. Trump either didn't know that or didn't care. Though I'd spend the next several weeks quite memorably and disastrously trying to make this point to him and his staff. On Friday, January 27th, 2017, 21 days into my relationship with Donald Trump, I was back at the White House. I had been eating my lunch at my desk, as usual, when my assistant, Althea James, connected a woman calling from the White House and telling me to hold for the president. He came on the line to ask if I wanted to come over for dinner that night. This was not normal, but I felt like I had no choice. I replied, "Of course, sir." He asked whether 6 or 6:30 would be better. I said, "Whatever works for you, sir." He chose 6:30. I hung up and then called Patrice to break a Thai food dinner date. That afternoon, I saw the recently retired Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, at an event at the FBI, where we were awarding him the rare status of honorary special agent. As we stood waiting to walk on stage, I told him about the dinner invitation, explaining that it made me deeply uncomfortable. He assumed it would be a group event, saying he had heard others were being invited to dinner at the White House. That made me relax a bit. There was no way a president would be dining alone with the FBI director. Someone at the White House had to have told him that it just wasn't done, at least not since the days of Nixon and Hoover. I recalled when President Obama invited me to the White House for a wide-ranging conversation before I was nominated, because, as he explained, "Once you're director, we won't be able to talk like this," meaning he would not be able to debate wide-ranging philosophical issues with me. The head of the FBI could not be put into the position of meeting and chatting privately with the President of the United States, especially after an election like 2016. The very notion would compromise the Bureau's hard-won integrity and independence. My fear was that Trump expected exactly that. I arrived at the White House on West Executive Drive, the small roadway between the basement entrance to the White House and the old Executive Office Building. The FBI security team stopped the vehicle at the same awning-covered entrance I used to go to the Situation Room. I walked in and told the Secret Service officer on duty that I was here for dinner with the president. He looked slightly confused and asked me to have a seat. Shortly thereafter, a young woman escorted me on the long walk through the West Wing, along the Rose Garden, and into the ground floor of the White House residence. She took me up a staircase I had never seen before, which emptied next to the green room on the main floor. As I waited in the doorway, I chatted with two Navy stewards while discreetly looking around for the president's other dinner guests. The stewards were African-American men close to my age and had been working at the White House for about 10 years. They were each well over 6 feet tall, and yet both had worked on submarines during their active duty years. Naturally, this led to a conversation about the headroom on subs, and one reported that the bunks were 6 feet 4 inches long, which was precisely his height. Chuckling, we agreed a submarine was no place for me. Standing at the entrance to the green room as we continued waiting and chatting, I saw it. A table unmistakably set for two. One place setting was marked with a calligraphy card reading, Director Comey. The other spot, presumably, was for the president. I was deeply uncomfortable, and not just because I did not love the idea of a third discussion of Russian hookers. The president arrived at the appointed time of 6:30 p.m. The compliment soon followed. Seeing me standing already in the doorway, he said, I like that. I like people are on time. I think a leader should always be on time. He was wearing his usual dark blue suit, white shirt, and too long red tie. He did not speak to the stewards at all. He gestured me to the table, which sat us about 4 feet apart and was placed directly beneath the ornate chandelier in the center of the rectangular room. As the name suggests, the walls of the green room are covered in the silk fabric of that color. I read afterward that John Adams used it as a bedroom, and Thomas Jefferson made it a dining room, but presidents since have used it as a sitting room. That evening, the furniture had been removed in favor of our small dining table. Over the president's right shoulder, I could see one of two statues that stand on either side of the fireplace, the white marble mantelpiece resting on their heads, which looked really painful. On my plate, I found a large cream-colored card describing the entire four-course menu in cursive script. Salad, shrimp scampi, chicken parmesan with pasta, and vanilla ice cream. The president began by admiring his own menu card, which he held up. They write these things out one at a time by hand, he marveled, referring to the White House staff. A calligrapher, I replied, nodding. He looked quizzical. They write them by hand, he repeated. At some point early on, maybe by the time the Navy stewards brought us the shrimp scampi, Trump asked bluntly, So what do you want to do? It was an odd question that I didn't entirely understand at first, but without waiting for an answer, he launched into a monologue that made it crystal clear what he was referring to, whether I wanted to keep my job. He said lots of people wanted to be director of the FBI, but that he thought very highly of me. He said that he heard great things about me and knew the people of the FBI thought very highly of me as well. He said despite that, he would understand if I wanted to walk away, given all I had been through. Although then he noted that that would be bad for me personally because it would look like I had done something wrong. He finished by saying he knew he could make a change at FBI if he wanted to, but that he wanted to know what I thought. Now it was pretty clear to me what was happening. The setup of the dinner, both the physical layout of a private meal, and Trump's pretense that he had not already asked me to stay on multiple occasions, convinced me this was an effort to establish a patronage relationship. Somebody probably had told him, or maybe it just occurred to him at random, that he'd given me the job for free, and that he needed to get something in return. This only added to the strangeness of the experience. The President of the United States had invited me to dinner and decided my job security was on the menu. I responded that I agreed he can fire the FBI director anytime he wishes, but that I wanted to stay and do a job I loved and thought I was doing well. I said I didn't expect to return to government, but found the job hugely rewarding and wanted to serve out my term. Sensing he needed more from me, I added that he could count on me as being reliable in one way, not in the way political people sometimes use the term, like a reliable vote for one team. I said he could count on me to always tell him the truth. I didn't do sneaky things, I told him, and I don't leak. But, I said, I'm not on anybody's side politically, and could not be counted on in the traditional political sense, explaining that that was in the president's best interest. The FBI and the Department of Justice are drawn into the most controversial investigations in the country, investigations that frequently involve prominent members of a presidential administration, as we had been with the investigation of Karl Rove and Scooter Libby during the Bush administration. The FBI is able to do that work credibly because it is not, and is not seen as, a tool of the president. Without that reputation and reality at both Justice and the FBI, a president is left with no way to resolve investigations of his administration, short of appointment of some kind of special prosecutor. This discourse obviously did not appease him. A short time later, with a serious look on his face, he said, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty." During the silence that followed, I didn't move, speak, or change my facial expression in any way. The president of the FBI is able to do that work credibly because it is not, and is not seen as, a tool of the president. Without that reputation and reality at both Justice and the FBI, a president is left with no way to resolve investigations of his administration, short of appointment of some kind of special prosecutor. This discourse obviously did not appease him. A short time later, with a serious look on his face, he said, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty." During the silence that followed, I didn't move, speak, or change my facial expression in any way. The President of the United States just demanded the FBI director's loyalty. This was surreal. To those inclined to defend Trump, they might consider how it would have looked if President Obama had called the FBI director to a one-on-one dinner during an investigation of senior officials in his administration, then discussed his job security, and then said he expected loyalty. There would undoubtedly be people appearing on Fox News calling for Obama's impeachment in an instant. This, of course, was not something I could ever conceive of Obama doing, or George W. Bush, for that matter. To my mind, the demand was like Sammy the Bull's Cosa Nostra induction ceremony, with Trump in the role of the family boss, asking me if I have what it takes to be a made man. I did not, and would never. I was determined not to give the president any hint of assent to this demand, so I gave silence instead. We looked at each other for what seemed an eternity, but was maybe 2 seconds or so. I stared again at the soft white pouches under his expressionless blue eyes. I remember thinking in that moment that the president doesn't understand the FBI's role in American life, or care about what the people there spent 40 years building. Not at all. In an earlier time in my career, and at a younger age, I wouldn't have had the nerve to keep my composure, to not break the icy stare with a nod or some muffled word signaling agreement. Even at the age of 56, with a fair number of scars, and in my 4th year as director of the FBI, I still had to talk to myself, as I sat inches from the president, staring him directly in the face. The voice inside said, "Don't do anything. Don't you dare move." Trump broke the awkward standoff, looking down at his plate and moving to another topic. My cold response didn't seem to faze him much, if at all. Dinner continued, pleasantly enough. As we continued our encounter, I don't use the word conversation, because the term doesn't apply when one person speaks nearly the entire time. I tried to help President Trump understand the value that the separation between the FBI and the White House offers the president, but it was very hard to get a word in. For the rest of the meal, pausing only now and then to eat, he spoke in torrents, gushing words about the size of his inauguration crowd, how much free media coverage he'd been able to generate during the election, the viciousness of the campaign. He offered his view of the Clinton email investigation, referring to it in 3 phases, each of which, in his telling, bore my name. In Comey 1, he said, "I saved her with my July 5th announcement that there was no prosecutable case against her," although he added that I was wrong about that conclusion. In what he called Comey 2, I did what I had to do by informing Congress that we had restarted the investigation. In Comey 3, which was my final letter to Congress, closing the case for a second time, he said I saved Hillary again, but that she totally misplayed that. He sounded like he was reciting the plot line to his favorite TV show. He talked about the trappings of the White House, saying something to the effect of, "This is luxury, and I know luxury." I remember glancing again at the one poor statue I could see over his shoulder with the mantelpiece on its head and thinking that made sense. He went into another explanation, I'd seen many of them on television, about how he hadn't made fun of a disabled reporter. He said he hadn't mistreated a long list of women, reviewing each case in detail, as he had in our earlier conversation. There was no way he groped that lady sitting next to him on the airplane, he insisted, and the idea that he grabbed a porn star and offered her money to come to his room was preposterous. His method of speaking was like an oral jigsaw puzzle contest, with a shot clock. He would, in rapid-fire sequence, pick up a piece, put it down, pick up an unrelated piece, put it down, return to the original piece, on and on. But it was always him picking up the pieces and putting them down. None of this behavior, incidentally, was the way a leader could or should build rapport with a subordinate. All of us struggle to realize something Patrice spent years telling me as I took on one position or another. It's not about you, dear. She often needed to remind me that whatever people were feeling, happy, sad, frightened, or confused, it was unlikely it had anything to do with me. They had received a gift or lost a friend or gotten a medical test result or couldn't understand why their love wasn't calling them back. It was all about their lives, their troubles, their hopes and dreams, not mine. The nature of human existence makes it hard for us, or at least for me, to come to that understanding naturally. After all, I can only experience the world through me. That tempts all of us to believe everything we think, everything we hear, everything we see is all about us. I think we all do this. But a leader constantly has to train him or herself to think otherwise. This is an important insight for a leader in two respects. First, it allows you to relax a bit, secure in the knowledge that you aren't that important. Second, knowing people aren't always focused on you should drive you to try to imagine what they are focused on. I see this as the heart of emotional intelligence, the ability to imagine the feelings and perspective of another me. Some seem to be born with a larger initial deposit of emotional intelligence, but all of us can develop it with practice. Well, most of us. I got the sense that no one ever taught this to Donald Trump. The president asked me very few questions that might prompt a discussion. Instead, he made constant assertions, leaving me wondering whether, by my silence, I had just agreed with everyone that he had the biggest inauguration crowd in history, had given a great inauguration speech, had never mistreated women, and so on. The barrage of words was almost designed to prevent a genuine two-way dialogue from ever happening. Then there were the baffling, unnecessary lies. At one point, for example, the president told me that Chief of Staff Reince Priebus didn't know we were meeting, which seemed incredible. A chief of staff should know when the president is dining alone with the FBI director. Then, later on in that same dinner, Trump said casually, "Reince knows we're meeting." Unprompted, and in another zag in the conversation, he brought up what he called the golden showers thing, repeating much of what he had said to me previously, adding that it bothered him if there was even a 1% chance his wife Melania thought it was true. That distracted me slightly, because I immediately began wondering why his wife would think there was any chance, even a small one, that he had been with prostitutes urinating on each other in Moscow. For all my flaws, there is a 0% chance, literally absolute zero, that Patrice would credit an allegation that I was with hookers peeing on each other in Moscow. She would laugh at the very suggestion. In what kind of marriage, to what kind of man, does a spouse conclude there is only a 99% chance her husband didn't do that? I'm almost certain the president is unfamiliar with the proverb, "the wicked flee when no man pursueth," because he just rolled on, unprompted, explaining why it couldn't possibly be true, ending by saying he was thinking of asking me to investigate the allegation to prove it was a lie. I said it was up to him. At the same time, I expressed the concern that such a thing would create a narrative that we were investigating him personally, and added that it was also very difficult to prove something never happened. He said I might be right, but repeatedly asked me to think about it, and said he would as well. One of his few questions, again seemingly out of nowhere, was to ask me how I compared Attorneys General Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch. I explained that Holder was much closer to President Obama, which had its advantages and its perils. I used the opportunity as an excuse to again explain why it was so important that the FBI and the Department of Justice be independent of the White House. I said it was a paradox. Throughout history, some presidents have decided that because problems come from justice, they should try to hold the department close. But blurring those boundaries ultimately makes the problems worse by undermining public trust in the institutions and their work. I got no sense he had any idea about or interest in what I was saying. Something else occurred to me about President Trump at that dinner that I found very instructive. I don't recall seeing him laugh, ever.